Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We'll lead off today with our week in review, beginning with a raise for the state's lowest earning workers as Massachusetts prepares to approve the nation's highest minimum wage.
We know it is long overdue. There are people for whom this will make a huge difference.
Also this week, Governor Deval Patrick unveils a package of measures to tackle the state's opioid addiction crisis.
It's affecting more kids. It's affecting every neighborhood. We have a public health emergency.
Plus, Boston makes the cut as a possible host city for the 2024 Summer Olympics.
The Olympics are the biggest sporting event in the world, and why not try to bring those to our backyard?
And Massachusetts Democrats head to Worcester for their party's convention, including five candidates who want to be the state's next governor.
All that and more in today's Week in Review. Joining us now are Peter Kanellis, the Boston Globe's editorial page editor. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Sasha.
And also John Carroll, a communications professor at Boston University and a blogger at campaignoutsider.com. John, hi to you, too.
Hi to you.
All right, so let's start with the minimum wage. This week, Senate and House leaders announced that they've reached a deal to raise the minimum wage from $8 an hour to $11 an hour by 2017. That's a 38% increase over the next 3 years. The Senate approved the bill yesterday by a vote of 35-4. The House is expected to approve it next week. That would make Massachusetts the highest statewide minimum wage in the nation. Many people applauded the bill's passage, including Jeff Hall of the Wage Action Coalition.
We need to think about the way we pay workers and the consequences it has, not just for their families, not just for future generations, but for our community right now.
But others, such as Westfield Republican State Senator Donald Humison, say raising the minimum wage will increase other costs.
I really seriously have concerns about whether or not that minimum wage increase will benefit those poor folks in the long run.
Critics say the 38% raise over 3 years would cost jobs, hurt businesses, even forcing some to close. So, gentlemen, the vote comes amidst growing national concern about stagnant wages, growing income inequality. Does raising the minimum wage help? Does it help enough? Peter Kanellis, let me start with you.
I think it helps a lot. I think there's a small downside, especially for, you know, emerging kind of mom and pop companies and things like that, stores that are coming along that might want to pay somebody a little less. We had advocated editorially that there should be an exception for teenage summer employment, for example. But overall, there's a lot of room for people to be making more than they are today, more than the $8 an hour in jobs like fast food and other areas. And I think it will help. It'll help a lot of struggling families, and it'll also help the Commonwealth by taking a certain number of people off of public assistance roles.
John, what's your view on the minimum wage in Massachusetts?
This economic argument is a lot like paper versus plastic. You know, you can argue it round, you can argue it flat. Everybody's acting according to form. The Democrats on Beacon Hill are all basically for this to one degree or another. The House was going to go up 10.50. The Senate wanted to go up 11. And the my favorite line was from MassLive.com. It said, Senate Republicans, all four of them, voted against the compromise. They're pretty predictable in that way. And the business people are entirely predictable. They're talking about a knee-buckling 38% increase. I think that this is one of those things that the moment is right. The state is basically engineered to do this. So I think it's going to go through, and I think everybody's going to adapt. The thing that I find the most depressing is that one in six workers in the state is making minimum wage. That feels like a lot to me.
Mm. Well, according to the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, an $11 minimum wage would raise wages for 500,000 people in the state, so that's pretty significant. But some folks on the left point out that raising the minimum wage is a limited way to address income inequality. It doesn't benefit the poorest of the poor, and it doesn't take from the richest. So, Peter, I mean, should the legislature continue to sort of think about ways to other anti-poverty strategies, like the earned income tax credit, for example, other more targeted measures to to deal with this situation.
Well, that's true. I mean, well, I, their earned income tax credit is a federal program, but I don't know if there's any state proposal that's like that. But there are certainly, I mean, economic growth and finding ways to promote growth in underserved areas like the gateway cities, where a lot of that one in six who are making the minimum wage, a lot of those people are living there, it makes a lot of sense. You know, we have an economic strategy in Massachusetts that favors a knowledge economy in Boston, and anybody who is not part of that world or benefiting from it in some way is greatly disadvantaged, whether they're in Boston or whether they're in the western part of the state where there are very few jobs in the knowledge economy. So we need to think of other strategies, but growth-oriented strategies to help raise wages for low-income workers.
Yeah. John.
Can I just throw in real quickly, there's an X factor here, which is there are signatures being collected for a ballot question that that does something that the House Senate compromise would not do, which is index the minimum wage to inflation. They might still go on, even though this bill passes. They might continue in this ballot question. So again, that's a sort of an uncertainty around this whole thing.
Yeah, that's Raise Up Massachusetts. They say they're going to decide whether or not to pursue that ballot initiative. They'll be deciding that next week.
And John and Peter, I'd like to get your thoughts on the state's opiate addiction problem, which is quite widespread. And as we heard on Tuesday, Governor Patrick has announced a new $20 million plan to try to fight this problem.
Prescription painkillers are dangerous in and of themselves and also a gateway to heroin. And yet there is overprescription of prescription painkillers. And the average age of the addicted population is getting younger and younger.
So to try to solve that problem, the governor wants hundreds of new treatment beds. He wants more services targeted to adolescents and young adults, a new public awareness campaign. But of course, we hear some people say we have to look more at the front end than the back end. We have to look at overprescription of opiates by doctors and patients who doctor shop to get multiple prescriptions. Did the two of you hear anything in this plan that if it were fully funded, you think would make a difference in tackling this problem? John, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, $20 million is lunch money, really. And you just wonder how far is that going to go. It's a very ambitious plan and a proposal. And I think that it says a lot of the right things. The one thing it doesn't talk about, and this isn't so much for prescription drugs as for heroin, is law enforcement. There is no law enforcement component to this, to say, you know, let's get some of this off the streets. And I think that that would be something that could have as widespread an effect as some of the treatment proposals that they have on the table.
Peter, we also heard the government say that next Tuesday there will be a summit of other New England governors. He'll be getting together with them to talk about the cross-border issue, drugs going back and forth from Vermont and New Hampshire to Massachusetts. I'm interested in your thoughts on this multi-prong approach to trying to solve the problem.
Well, it is sort of a logistical kind of document. I mean, it's very practical. It looks at things like, you know, adding a clinic in Franklin County, which currently doesn't have one. So it's not a, you know, big picture strategy, as John was alluding to. I think that what you had said earlier about really taking a hard look at prescription of painkillers is a worthwhile approach, because there seems to be a growing trove of evidence that people are moving from OxyContin, which is more expensive, to heroin, which is cheaper, after becoming addicted to prescription painkillers, many of which were obtained illegally, but they were obtained through people who got them through, you know, doctors and then sold them illegally. And, you know, there has to be a way to control the prescriptions of these opioids. And the bank that is in Patrick's plan, which is a registry that he's asking doctors to sign up with, you know, may be too little too late, and they need to be more aggressive about cracking down on overprescription.
The attention on this problem has gotten so focused recently. And, you know, one of our reporters, Deb Becker, was on Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket last week reporting on the opiate problem on the island. Six fatal overdoses on Martha's Vineyard since August, needles discarded on secluded beaches, house break-ins targeting not just unoccupied summer homes, but any houses that might have opiates in their medicine cabinets. Do the two of you sense that there is truly new raised public awareness about just how widespread this problem is?
I'm not sure that there is, actually. I think it hit the public radar screen when the governor of Vermont devoted his entire State of the State speech to this heroin problem and has been very active and is one of the outspoken voices that's going to be at that Summit of Governors this week or next week. Sorry. I think that that all of that is interesting, but I don't think that it's really registering with the public all that much. I think this made a ping on the radar screen, but it's probably going to disappear again right after the summit.
Let's move on. And you still have to call this a long shot, a real long shot. But today we learned that Boston is still in the running to host the 2024 Summer Olympics. The U.S. Olympic Committee, its short list includes Los Angeles, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Boston. Over the next 6 months, the USOC will decide whether it even wants to bid in the process to host the Olympics. But until then, it will be up to Boston and the other three cities to make their cases. So this is very exciting news for the group of prominent business and civic leaders pushing for this in Boston. But depending on your point of view, it's also a potential nightmare for Boston. What do you think, John? Is this something that Boston should push hard for?
I'm just sitting here wondering how many flyovers we'll need to add to get to the Cape in 2024 if we do this. I think that this is a pipe dream for a lot of people. I think when you look at the practical matter, is this the best way to employ the resources of the region? I'm not really sure. If you look at London, they spent more than $14 billion on the 2012 Olympics. And when you ask them, what did you get out of it? They talk about legacy, which is Latin for we lost a boatload of money on this thing. So so I'm just really not sure that that this is the wisest economic thing. But from a flag-waving standpoint, I think it's terrific.
Peter, a few weeks back, we had former city councilor Mike Ross on our show, and he's a big fan of this idea. And his argument, and I know he wrote about this in your paper as well, that hosting the Olympics is like hosting a big dinner party with your friends, and it forces you to clean things up. And in Boston's case, that would mean big improvements to housing, public transit, and infrastructure. Is that a good argument in favor of this?
100%. I'm one of those people who shares the pipe dream. I think people are.
Sorry, Peter. Didn't mean to step on your toes.
That's okay. I'm bracing for disappointment here, but I do think that it's easy for people to step in and sort of say, "Well, wait a minute. If I were there, and it's $14 billion, why don't we spend $14 billion on the poor? Or why don't we spend $14 billion cleaning up the roads and bridges? And why don't we spend $14 billion on something else?" But the fact is, half of it's federal money, and the other half is are projects that could be reused and that will actually become some of those worthy things, worthy infrastructure investments that people are talking about. A lot of it would be upgrading public transit. We need to do that anyway. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is building the Olympic Village. We have a housing crisis here. There should be some synergies there. So I think that, it's a positive statement. I'm actually very pleased that Boston and its civic leaders kind of got together and pushed for this. It reflects a kind of can-do attitude that has been missing at times
Peter,
civic life.
What's your sense? I introduced this subject by calling it a really long shot. I mean, we're on Boston is on a short list of just four cities. And then I know you're competing with against cities like Paris, Rome, Istanbul, and cities like that. But how much of a long shot is it? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. I mean, it's very, very hard to know because we don't know, first of all, how elaborate the other U.S. cities' proposals are. We also don't know how deep the skepticism of the USOC is about making a bid against some of these countries, where it really is a national effort and an effort of national pride. If it's Paris, it's going to be all paid for by the French government, and they're going to put every last dollar into it. And there's a feeling in the U.S. that there've got to be limits on this, which is an entirely reasonable impulse. But I don't know whether the USOC is kind of deeply skeptical or just slightly skeptical, and I don't know whether some of the other cities, I mean, Los Angeles has hosted an Olympics before, presumably that would be quite a bit easier for them to ramp up this time. I don't know about those other proposals and whether they're just fundamentally more feasible than ours.
John, final thought from you on this.
Since Mike Ross brought up the dinner reference, can I just propose a bake-off here among the four cities? So you've got Boston cream pie, you've got rice-a-roni for San Francisco, sushi for L.A., and of course, hors d'oeuvres paid for by lobbyists for D.C. I think that would be a terrific way to decide this.
Where do you get these ideas, John?
It's just amazing. I have a lot of spare time.
This is why we bring you in. It's fantastic.
All right, some politics talk, which is that the State Democratic Convention kicks off in Worcester tonight. And among other things, the 6,000 delegates will vote on which of the five gubernatorial candidates to endorse. So, of course, they have A.G. Martha Coakley, State Treasurer Steve Grossman, Don Berwick, mostly known for his health care work, Juliet Kayyem, former Homeland Security person, Joe Avalone, Wellesley businessman. In order to get on the primary ballot in September, each candidate needs to get 15% of the delegate vote. Peter, how do you see the shaking out? Who's the front runner? Who might not make 15%?
Well, I think it's very clear that Coakley and Grossman will make the 15%. I think the other three are all to some degree in peril. You hear some people say Berwick is going to get it. I mean, by proposing his single-payer health insurance plan, he sort of cornered the left wing, and there are a number of delegates who will just vote for the most liberal candidate. A lot of people think Kayyem is kind of on the bubble, maybe close. A lot of people think Avalone may not make it. I think this is a terrible rule, and the Democrats are really shooting themselves in the foot over this. The Republicans have the same rule, and they also shot themselves in the foot over this, so it's a bipartisan disaster. But
you think it should be left to primary voters rather than
to delegates? Well, it absolutely should be up to primary voters. I mean, what they said is the rule is actually more restrictive than you described. It's 15% on the first ballots. You have five candidates, and the five candidates, if they all get 15%, that accounts for 75% of the delegates right there. That's not going to happen. You're almost artificially forcing a winnowing of the field here. And it's a winning of the field by insiders who are delegates. I know some people say they were voted on at caucuses, and these are the people who really care, and they're the activists. They're the ones who get out there. But it's an inside game, and it doesn't look good to voters. And I just think that cutting off new voices at a time when there's a fair amount of dissatisfaction about the field in general is a terrible idea for the Democratic Party.
John Carroll, as we just heard Peter Kunnelis say, Martha Coakley and Steve Grossman are expected to get on the primary ballot, each get 15%. But explain something to us, because even though they both expect to get on the ballot, Grossman is expected to get the endorsement of the delegates. Yet in a recent poll of likely voters, he was 35% behind Martha Coakley. So tell us why that disconnect exists.
Right. First of all, just as far as the entire field, if everyone gets what they're predicting, that will amount to 130% of the delegates at the convention.
So take it with a grain of salt.
It's like when Billy Sullivan sold 400% of the New England Patriots way back when. at any rate, as far as those numbers, you're talking about two different universes. The poll of likely Democratic voters is very different body from the delegates. The delegates are the hardcore faithful. They're still suspicious of Martha Coakley because of her loss to Scott Brown in 2010. And they still have doubts about her ability as a campaigner. Plus, Steve Grossman would go to the opening of an envelope. So he has been courting these guys like crazy. So I think that he has sort of the inside game down. But as far as name recognition, Martha Coakley has him beat by far. So she's 35 points ahead in this survey of likely Democratic voters. And I think that's the hurdle for him. He'll get a bump coming out of the convention, but how big a bump is yet to be seen.
And Peter, very quick question for you about Juliet Kayyem, who, of course, used to write op-eds for The Globe. You know, she is one of the three people who really need to try to distinguish herself to get above that 15% margin. And anyone who knows her knows she's someone with a lot of sass and energy. But she has, I think was a little sanitized when the campaign began. I'm wondering if you sort of feel like in the run-up to this, you've seen more of that come out in her attempt to distinguish herself.
Well, we hosted an opinion live stream lab debate with these candidates, and she was indeed sassy in the debate. I don't know. I can't predict whether that's going to make a big difference to delegates. I think that there may be some delegates who in the last week or two have kind of woken up to the idea that if all three of the long shot candidates are kept off the ballot and it's just Coakley and Grossman who make it, that it really will make the party look bad. So there may be some delegates who are kind of making strategic choices in the goal of getting more voices on the ballot and having a more spirited primary race for the fall.
All right. Democratic convention coming up in Worcester momentarily. So let's move on to our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold, as we say this week. John Carroll, let me start with you about your hubbub.
Yeah, well, my hubbub on Monday, Chicago lawyer named Joseph Zinger ran an ad in the Boston Herald, the second ad he's run in the Boston area, citing Amy Lord's murder last year and calling for law enforcement officials to release more data on ATM crime. He also accuses the Globe, and I'm sorry about this, Peter, accuses the Globe of using misleadingly low numbers when they report on this issue. On the flip side, Peter, he doesn't cite the Herald for anything. So
that's, well, the Globe is under the thumb of ATMs.
Yeah, right. That's always interesting. At any rate, the interesting...
The ATM lobbies.
Right, exactly. Exactly. The interesting thing is that Joseph Zinger holds a patent for a duress code system for ATMs, which he says he's not going to make any money off this because the patent is going to expire, but his hope is to trigger a class action suit. And did I mention that he's a lawyer? So, I'm wondering, there's been virtually no coverage of this. And, this guy is in trying to influence a whole lot of people in Boston and hasn't been getting very much scrutiny at all.
Really interesting. Peter Canellos, how about your hubbub?
A Mansfield town selectman used his public line to tweet out an obnoxious, what a lot of people thought was an obnoxious tweet. He took a picture of a Lowe's improvement store help wanted ad in Spanish and said something like, you know, what kind of service can you expect from a company that puts an ad out like this? That was seen as offensive by a lot of people. Other people saw it there. What it suggests is the way that Twitter is coarsening our public dialogue. And I would advise public officials out there to be doubly careful when you tweet things out, because we've seen a lot of instances of it blowing up in people's faces.
Mm. Sasha.
All right. Mine falls in the category of give credit where credit is due, which is that the American Waterworks Association had an annual conference this week in Boston, and Boston won the best tap water taste test. MWRA, which I think about more than a million people in greater Boston every day drink this water. It was judged on its flavor characteristics. I actually emailed one of the judges, Peter Howe, former Globe reporter who now works for New England Cable News. I said, Peter, what were the flavor characteristics you were kidding? You were judging. He said his notes include things like flat, bland, sulfurous, distilled water tasting, and this is my favorite one, used socks aftertaste. Presumably Boston's did not have that taste, but we did come in first place.
All right. Well, Somerville didn't win that competition, but listen to this. An issue near and dear to my heart, rat control from the town of Somerville, my hometown, by the way. So they're hoping to pilot a program that would bait rat traps with birth control. And basically the city, this by the way, according to the Somerville Neighborhood News, basically the city would deploy boxes with bait inside containing medicine that would make rats infertile. City officials say they're ready to deploy the traps, but they're waiting for the green light from the Environmental Protection Agency. So,
have we heard any protests from the religious quarters?
Give them time. Yeah. Give them time. John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and blogger at campaignoutsider.com. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter Canellos, always a pleasure. He's the editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Anthony.
And stay with us. Coming up, we're going to be hearing about the Massachusetts Senate voting to extend publicity rights to the dead. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.